From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The blame for Iraqi suffering does not rest with the international community. It rests with Saddam Hussein.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, feminist heroine or macho hawk? Then a four-star retired British general speaks out against NATO.
Basically, it's the wrong answer to a very pressing question.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf today says that Iraq supports a Russian proposal to allow UN inspections of all Iraqi sites in order to avoid a military strike. He told reporters after talks with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo, "This is the effort that Iraq supports totally, and we hope this effort is supported so that diplomatic means can work to avoid a military crisis." He was referring to a Russian proposal aimed at ending a standoff with the United Nations after Iraq obstructed access to weapons inspectors and the United States threatened to force it to comply by using a military strike. The commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East said today he would be ready to strike Iraq within about a week. Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni said during a tour of the Gulf with U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen, "I would say we're within a week or so." Secretary of Defense William Cohen said that although Persian Gulf nations supported United States efforts to force Iraq to cooperate with United Nations weapons inspectors, he'd failed to win new support for military strikes. Members of a White House panel warned President Clinton that a potential link between the illnesses of Persian Gulf war vets and exposure to poison gas should be of concern as the United States threatens to bomb Iraqi poison gas sites. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan urged all parties to be more flexible in finding a peaceful solution to the Iraqi crisis. President Clinton is kicking off his campaign today to win Senate approval for NATO expansion. Clinton is to sign formal protocols at the State Department with the foreign ministers of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic looking on. A vote on adding those three countries to the Western alliance is expected within 2 months. If the Senate and other current members approve, the three would join next year. The Marine Corps has relieved a colonel of command, saying he told his crew to get rid of any evidence in last week's Italian ski gondola accident that killed 20 people. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Waters was relieved on Friday, 3 days after a Marine jet on a training flight from the Aviano Air Base severed a ski lift cable, sending a gondola crashing to the ground. The U.S. military has acknowledged the plane, an EA-6B Prowler, was well below the approved altitude of 500 feet. Illegal campaign contributions to the Democratic Party National Committee in the 1996 election originated in bank accounts in the Greater China area. This according to a final report from the Republican senators investigating campaign finance abuses. But the committee said it could not establish that the Chinese government had funded, directed, or encouraged the illegal contributions. Dr. David Satcher, the 56-year-old director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, won Senate confirmation as Surgeon General yesterday, becoming the first person in more than 3 years to fill a post that has become a lightning rod in the nation's battles over abortion and family values. A former Secret Service officer reportedly says Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton were alone together in the Oval Office. Louis Fox tells The Washington Post the president spent at least 40 minutes alone with the former White House intern one weekend afternoon in late 1995 while he was posted outside the door of the Oval Office. In Clinton's deposition in the Paula Jones case last month, he reportedly testified he couldn't recall ever having been alone with Lewinsky. President Clinton's attempt to move up the trial date in the sexual harassment case against him has been denied by a federal judge. Clinton's lawyers had sought a March 23rd trial, arguing that alleged gag order violations by Paula Corbin Jones' lawyers harmed the president's legal defense and the presidency itself. A spokesperson for the Maine Won't Discriminate organization is conceding defeat in the repeal of the state's gay rights law. The Christian Coalition of Maine, a leading force in the repeal effort, is claiming victory. Voters yesterday made Maine the first state to repeal its gay rights law. The law had added sexual orientation to the protected classifications in Maine's 25-year-old Human Rights Act. And the jury in the sexual misconduct trial of the Army's former top enlisted man heard a tape recording yesterday. In it, the defendant is heard instructing one of his alleged victims to tell investigators he was doing nothing more than offering her career advice. Sergeant Jean McKinney is on trial. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Dutch Prime Minister Wim Kok, denying any shift in policy towards Iraq, yesterday, or today actually, dismissed reports that the Netherlands would support a military strike by the United States. He also flatly contradicted remarks by a junior defense minister that suggested the Netherlands would send a frigate to the Gulf to back up any U.S. action. The Dutch State Secretary for Defense said during a visit to Washington that Dutch Defense Minister Joris Voorhoof had offered at the weekend to send a frigate, but the comments were echoed by U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She told a Senate hearing yesterday there was increasing international support for military action if diplomatic efforts fail to persuade Iraq to open up suspected weapon sites to U.N. inspectors. The Netherlands was among nations to have offered their backing, she added. But again, Koch said there had been no change in the government line. He's maintained political and diplomatic efforts must continue to avoid a use of military force against Iraq and reinforce the message in a weekend telephone conversation with U.S. President Bill Clinton. At yesterday's Senate Foreign Relations hearing, Madeleine Albright was very firm on what the U.S. plans to do if Saddam Hussein doesn't change his policy.
The blame for Iraqi suffering does not rest with the international community. It rests with Saddam Hussein. As President Clinton has made clear, we will not allow Baghdad to get away with flagrantly violating its obligations. Saddam does not have a menu of choices. He has one. Iraq must comply with the UN Security Council resolutions and provide UN inspectors with the unfettered access they need to do their job.
And that was, again, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And today we're going to take a look at the first woman Secretary of State, formerly the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. We're joined right now in our Washington studio at Pacifica Station WPFW by Mark Brzozinski, Director of the Committee on the Middle East. He's a former Washington representative of the World Jewish Congress and founder and chairperson of the Jewish Committee on the Middle East. He's been a consultant on Middle East for, among others, the Congressional Quarterly, National Geographic Society, and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars at the Smithsonian. We're also joined by Martha Burke. Martha Burke is editor of Feminist FactsNet and president of the Center for the Advancement of Public Policy. She joins us on the telephone. Well, let's start off with Mark Brzozinski with the Committee on the Middle East. Mark, can you tell us your response, first of all, to this latest news about the Dutch prime minister saying that, in fact, despite the fact that Madeleine Albright suggested otherwise, that at least Holland has not changed its view of, or the Netherlands has not changed its view of Iraq and will not support a U.S. attack?
Well, good morning, Amy. You know, I've been in Washington almost 20 years since graduate school. I've been to the Middle East 150 times. The level of misleading statements, the level of duplicity, the level of manipulating the American people has never been higher. And in a sense, in my view, Madeleine Albright is the perfect representative of the Clinton administration. She does something very similar with our foreign policy in terms of misrepresenting reality, just like our president misrepresents much reality from the White House, especially his own. Let me just give you a quote, for instance, from Madeleine Albright just a week ago when she was in the Arab world. She actually said this publicly. She said, "Today I can report to you that the United States, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the Palestinian Authority are of one mind on this crisis." You don't even have to be a Middle East expert to know that this quote makes no sense. She could not even get support for our planes to be used from countries that are under our protection to attack Iraq. Whether she's a woman or not is not, for me, an important issue. The issue is that history is being made, that the policies the United States pursues now will have ramifications into the future, just like our past policies have created the situation we're in today. And in my view, since the subject is the Secretary of State, this woman for the last 4 or 5 years, including when she was at the United Nations, has been following policies that are designed quite literally to torture Iraq. 5% of the Iraqi people are dead because of U.S. sanctions. That's just in the last 7 years. The country has been totally devastated. It is practically prostrate at the moment. But, and here's something people in Washington just normally don't say in public, Middle East policy in the United States under the Clinton administration is largely controlled and manipulated by the Israeli Jewish lobby. I myself represented the World Jewish Congress many years ago. I'm intimately familiar with how these things work. When I did represent the World Jewish Congress, I arranged meetings on behalf of Jewish organizations at the White House. But I've never seen a Washington where practically every official is linked intimately to the Israeli Jewish lobby. And Madeleine Albright has done something that nobody in history has ever done. She has taken a former Israeli lobby official, someone who wasn't even a United States citizen at the time that Clinton was elected president. And she's made him her assistant secretary of state for the Middle East. It's an unprecedented situation. It's a terribly dangerous situation.
Who is that?
And the person in the White House, Martin Indyg, person in the State Department, excuse me, he used to be in the White House where he was national security advisor. He's also someone who, at the time of the Clinton election, was said to be overheard on a tape, since we're into tapes these days, surreptitious tapes. During the first Clinton campaign, Martin Indyg was named as a Jewish lobby operative who was in Little Rock in the Clinton campaign. And when Clinton became president, Clinton was going to do what the Israeli Jewish lobby wanted him to do. Now, the person who was heard on the tape was not a minor official. He was the president of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the most important lobbying organization on behalf of Israel and American Jews. Of course, they say they represent American Jews here in Washington. You've also got a man in the White House who is the president's right-hand man, Rahm Emanuel. He was a dual citizen until he was 18. In 1991, during the Gulf War, he volunteered for the Israeli army and was in Israel working as a, at that time, an American civilian working with the army. He's been working with the Israeli Jewish lobby all his adult life, intimately tied into it. So the reason I'm mentioning this is not because of my Jewish background. The reason I'm mentioning it is because it's important for the American people to understand that the foreign policy being pursued by the United States, Bill Clinton is no Middle East expert, and neither was Madeleine Albright, is being pursued because of the very close Israeli-American connection. And Israel's influence on this country has never been greater. And also, the United States is essentially pursuing Israel's policy toward Iraq. Let's not forget that it was the Israelis that first bombed Iraq in 1981 to condemnation from throughout the world. And they have lobbied for these policies strenuously year in and year out, and now they've brought them about.
Bombed them in 1981. Why? Bombed Iraq.
The Iraqis had a French nuclear reactor, OSIRAC, and the Israelis bombed it. Of course, the only country in the Middle East that has weapons of mass destruction is Israel itself. And another of the great ironies of the moment...
Well, has nuclear weapons, you're saying?
Yes, nuclear weapons. One of the great historic ironies, as far as I'm concerned, is here the United States is now saying to the Arab world, more than 20 countries in the Arab world, you may not have even the potential to develop weapons of mass destruction, any of you, but we and our ally Israel will send Patriot missiles to protect Israel's weapons of mass destruction. And last week, without too much fanfare, large numbers of Patriot missiles were sent to the Israeli south, about 43 miles from Dimona, Israel's once secret nuclear reactor. The Israeli army, in fact, is 8 times stronger, according to Jane's Military Review, than all the Arab armies combined. So what you're really witnessing in the Middle East is American hegemony, American imperialism, America pretty much saying to the region, we rule here, we tell people what to do, we and our ally will decide the economic and the military policies of this region. And of course, even the Arab client regimes, even our regimes, client regimes in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in Egypt, these regimes won't even publicly back our policies. They're too scared to do so. They're too weak to do so. I'm afraid this historic moment has the potential for, well, I won't go as far as Boris Yeltsin. I don't think we're on the verge of World War III. I don't think that there's anybody in the world who has military power that can oppose us if we decide to go ahead with the bombing campaign. But we will be setting forces alive. We will be unleashing forces. We will be fueling fundamentalism. And the ramifications of that for the future, I think, are very grave.
Well, Mark Brzezinski, again, director of the Jewish Committee on the Middle East, former Washington representative of the World Jewish Congress. As I said earlier, we're also joined by Martha Burke, editor of the Feminist Facts Net, president of the Center for the Advancement of Public Policy. I know that you have a very different view of the U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright.
Well, it's interesting. Mark's views sound a lot like a vast Jewish conspiracy is not only controlling the Middle East, but our foreign policy in general and probably the world in particular. But since the subject of the interview is not the Middle East policy, but the Secretary of State herself, I would like to pick up on a couple of statements he made about her. First, he said the fact that she is a woman is not important and that the policy that she makes and represents now has ramifications for the future. He's absolutely right about the ramifications for the future, and he's absolutely wrong that the fact that she is a woman does not make any difference. This Secretary of State has been the most outspoken Secretary of State on the global rights of women that we have ever had. She has done things that I know no male Secretary of State would have done, or they would have done it. And one example I will give you is we are the only industrialized nation in the world that has failed to sign the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, so-called CEDAW Treaty. It's been sitting in the Senate for over 18 years. Several Secretaries of State, of course, during that time have had opportunities that they did not take advantage of to try to move it out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One of the first things that Albright did was make a public statement directly to Jesse Helms when the two of them were together that said, get off the dime here, get this treaty out. It's an embarrassment to the United States and an affront to women all over the world. That's one example. I can give you others. She confronted the ministers of the Middle East at a meeting personally and individually and asked them to tell her why there were no women in their cabinets. I submit to you that a male secretary would never have done this. She has spoken out on many other things, including the treatment of women by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And in general, she is quite a good advocate for the Beijing platform on the global human rights of women. So whatever Mark thinks about her policies and actions regarding the Middle East, the fact is that she is an effective Secretary of State for half the world's population, and her actions do matter now for the future, and the fact that she is a woman is very important.
I'm going to break in here to allow stations to ID themselves. We're talking to Martha Burke, editor of the Feminist Facts Net and president of the Center for the Advancement of Public Policy. Our guest in the studio in Washington is Mark Brzezinski, director of the Committee on the Middle East. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back with them in just a minute. We'll be right back. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take a look at the policies of Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, former U.N. ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, we're joined by Martha Burke. She's editor of Feminist FactsNet, president of the Center for the Advancement of Public Policy, Mike Brzezinski, who is director of the Committee on the Middle East, and we've just been joined by Adete Akwe, who's director of Amnesty International for Africa. Now, most people may not associate Madeleine Albright with African policy, but of course she is Secretary of State, deals with all foreign policy. And in fact, she did recently just return from a trip through Southern Africa, and President Clinton will be following in her footsteps in just a few weeks. Adete Akwe, what is your assessment of Madeleine Albright in Africa?
Well, the trip generated a lot of controversy. On the one hand, it was incredibly very welcome and a great step forward that she actually met her commitment to visit Africa in the first year of her term as Secretary of State. And also the part of the message that was conveyed, acknowledgement and acceptance for disruptive, destructive U.S. policies in the past, and an acceptance of the U.S. lack of response or the failure of the U.S. to respond to the genocide in Rwanda in 1994 were all very welcome. But the negative part of the trip, I think, has been her policies regarding democracy and human rights. When she visited Ethiopia, Uganda, Rwanda, Angola, and Zimbabwe, as you mentioned, as long as South Africa, the issues of democracy and human rights were very much subtext. They were left to private conversations. And for many of us, that represented a step backwards from what we had hoped would be not only a strong message in support of reform, but also in support of civil society in Africa.
Adete Akwe, would you assess Madeleine Albright as simply a very good carrier out of foreign policy set, for example, by the White House, or that she is an architect of that foreign policy in Africa?
Well, she certainly pulled together a very impressive team. The new Assistant Secretary of State is Susan Rice. They've got new people in the NSC department.
The National Security Council.
Exactly. And but for the most part, the democracy and human rights policy has been the thing that's been lacking. As you may be aware, there is actually some economic policy they're trying to drive investment interest and move the continent away from its dependency on foreign aid. In some cases, that's going to have negative effects, but at least they are paying attention to the economic issues. The question is whether she's going to put her stamp on the democracy issues and human rights, because we believe that those are the fundamental ones that are going to either consolidate economic gains or at least help the continent move forward. And so far, we have not seen that. So I think, unfortunately, I'd have to say that she's more a carrier out of the policy, which, unfortunately, is not very well articulated and is not being very well implemented.
Explain the policy she promoted in Rwanda when she was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
Well, when she was there, reports of the genocide or the plans of the genocide reached the UN in March. Secret government documents revealing the detailed plans of what was going to be the genocide got to UN headquarters, and the Security Council refused to acknowledge that genocide was actually happening once the killings began. At the same time, the United States was among those countries that voted to withdraw, to scale down the peacekeeping force that was there, that was comprised primarily of Belgian troops. So there was a critical mistake made there and a critical lack of acceptance of responsibility to respond to this United Nations challenge. Then what happened afterwards is when they finally said that acts of genocidal intent were taking place, this was in May, at that point, there were delays and haggling over how much the peacekeeping force was going to be charged for using U.S. equipment. All of that served to delay the deployment of the troops and, of course, contributed to the 1 million people being killed.
And what was Madeleine Albright's role in that?
She was basically the key person who articulated those U.S. positions in the United Nations Security Council. The question is whether she fought an unsuccessful battle with the administration to try and get them to change their policy, and unfortunately, we don't have any sign of that.
Amy, if I may, I would add that while she was at the
Mark
United
Brzezinski.
Nations, while she was at the United Nations, she was also the primary person who covered up the Israeli Qana massacre, the first time in Middle East history when civilians under UN protection were attacked and massacred. This was in April of 1996, literally screaming and threatening. In southern Lebanon, literally, and I mean literally, screaming and hollering privately at Boutros Ghali that he better not release the UN report, which proved that Israel had done so purposefully rather than by mistake, and threatening Boutros Ghali that he wouldn't be supported by the United Nations to stay on for a second term. Now, we have a lot of information at our website, which is at middleeast.org, on these matters.
Amy, I would like to jump in and ask Adete, because I know that his organization has a human rights campaign vis-a-vis the oppression of the women by the Taliban government in Afghanistan. And Albright has been quite outspoken on that issue. I think she's been instrumental in preventing the United States from recognizing the Taliban as the official government over there. And when he says that she has not come through on human rights, I think that he's perhaps ignoring or forgetting about the human rights of women.
Adete Akwe?
Yes, no, I would certainly agree with you that she has definitely kept what has been an incredible eagerness to jump in and support the Taliban. But at the same time, it took concerted pressure to get the United States to have the war crimes tribunal in Rwanda and, for that matter, in Bosnia, recognize and prosecute the issue of rape, which was a major tool that was used by the Hutu-based government that committed the genocide. So, yes, she has. I think she's to be commended for her work in opposing recognition of the Taliban, but she could go much further. And, you know, I guess we have to see what happens now.
She has also been quite outspoken, though, on the issue of rape as a war crime.
Yeah, if I may, Amy, before this comes to an end, Martha made some comments earlier about myself. First of all, I think Martha's basic problem is she thinks that Madeleine Albright is Secretary for Women of the United States. Madeleine Albright is the Secretary of State of the United States.
And you think she's Secretary for the Middle East.
My comments would be the same about the policies she's pursuing, whether she were a man, whether she were a woman. She's not the Secretary of State for Women. She's
nor
the Secretary
the
of State for all of us. Now, if Martha feels that the most important thing about a person is that they're a woman, well, you know, she's entitled to her opinion. She also terribly misrepresented me by using the word Jewish conspiracy. First of all, I represented the World Jewish Congress in Washington. I was Phil Klutznik's assistant for 10 years. I've been to the Middle East many, many, many times. I gave specific facts, specific names, specific evidence about how Israel has an immense influence, and I believe an influence that we should not accept over our foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, since the Middle East is in the news today. My colleague in the studio, who I haven't met yet, is shaking his head in agreement. So, you know, I've never met Martha before, but I think she might want to actually focus on real policies rather than the fact that this person happens to be a woman.
And, of course, policies that affect women globally are not real policies. I think we've just put our finger on what the problem is with my colleague in the studio.
Explain, Martha Burr.
Well, he's obviously denigrating anything she does vis-a-vis the human rights and global rights of women as not very important. Is this because this is not guy stuff, and we've always had guy stuff in the
Martha,
in the,
it's too
State
ridiculous.
Department. Well, you
what
can
you're
say
suggesting,
it's
Martha,
too
is too ridiculous for me to comment on.
Well, all right. If it's too ridiculous for you to comment on, I'll comment on it. You're suggesting that anything she does in this area that I am concerned about is not important, while everything
she does... No, I'm suggesting...
Let Martha Burr finish, Mark.
Everything she does in the area you're concerned about, which is the Middle East, is very important. I think you made your own point. She is the Secretary of State and must address many, many areas of global policy. The Middle East is one. Human rights for women is another. And for you to say that this is trivial and what I want to talk about is really the real stuff, I think shows a bias that is pretty obvious. And in terms of your remarks about the Jews and what I called a Jewish conspiracy, I think that came straight out of your remarks. If you take an unbiased look at how you sound and obviously feel about this.
Martha,
it does
you
sound
give the
like
impression,
you believe there is a conspiracy.
Martha, if you give the impression that you know very little about the Middle East, so it's not something you should really discuss. As for women's issues, if the Secretary of State is doing good things on women issues, I don't know if the former Secretary of State did. It is not my field. I said that in the beginning.
That's right.
However,
and I think the program is about
the fact that,
Madeleine Albright
the fact
and not
that you
about
believe,
the Middle East.
The fact that you believe that simply because she's a woman and standing up for human rights issues that women are facing, which frankly I and most of my colleagues and friends do, is really amazing at a time when our foreign policy is for the first time in history about to pulverize an Arab state in the Middle East, creating huge historic waves that are going to impact on us for a great time to come.
We're talking to Mark Brzezinski, director of the Jewish Committee on the Middle East, based in Washington, D.C., Adete Akwe, director of Amnesty International for Africa in Washington, and Martha Burke, editor of Feminist FactsNet and president of the Center for the Advancement of Public Policy. I wanted to ask Martha Burke about the issue of the embargo against Iraq, not the details of it, but the protests around it are that we're talking about upwards of, I think, a million children who have died in Iraq because of the embargo. Now, Madeleine Albright has been a very strong defender of this embargo, both as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and as the Secretary of State. And I'm just wondering what your feeling is about that. I know tomorrow Bishop Gumbelton of Detroit will be in Washington, D.C. He and 53 other bishops sent a letter to President Clinton decrying the embargo, saying that it was immoral. Ironically, they sent it on the day that the Monica Lewinsky story broke, and so it didn't get attention. But there they were sending a letter to President Clinton saying that he was immoral for pushing this embargo. And tomorrow, Bishop Gumbelton will be in front of the White House involved with a protest. He's been on a hunger strike against the embargo now for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But what are your thoughts about Madeleine Albright and the embargo against Iraq?
Well, I think Adete is right when he says basically she has been a bringer of the message of the administration. She has clearly shown a strong backing of Bill Clinton in a number of areas, including the Lewinsky thing. I think you may remember that when they came out of the first cabinet meeting, that it was she and Donna Shalala who were put front and center to basically stand by their man.
What did you think of that?
I thought that it was a pretty clever ploy on the part of the White House and the administration. I was disappointed to have to recognize that it was, in their view, necessary. I want to acknowledge that Mark is correct. I'm not an expert on the Middle East, nor have I presented myself to be one. But I believe the topic today is Madeleine Albright herself and her job overall. So having said that, what I know as a citizen reading the newspapers like everyone else vis-a-vis the embargo, it hasn't been very effective. It has hurt a lot of children and other people who personally have nothing to do with this conflict. And in that sense, I would very much like to see some other tactics solve this problem, because this one clearly is not working, and it's hurting people that don't need to be hurt.
Let me give everyone a chance for final comments, beginning with Mark Brzezinski of the Jewish Committee on the Middle East.
Just quickly, I'll have to be consistent, I'm afraid, and disagree with Martha again. This woman, who's the Secretary of State, is not simply a bringer of Clinton's message. She is a primary policy formulator who has tremendous influence. I'd say she's probably the most influential person on our foreign policy right now. Let me give you another quote of hers. This comes from an interview with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes. Leslie Stahl asked her, apropos to your last question, Leslie Stahl, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died at Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?" Answer from Madeleine Albright: "I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it." Well, from the point of view of the Middle East, 5% of Iraq's people literally having died because of our policies in the last 7 years, and many, many more to die in the policies that we're pursuing at the moment. I think it's very important for people to realize that Madeleine Albright plays a central role in this and is very much responsible for this. And I hope that they will check out our own website, where we have a lot of information at MiddleEast.org.
And Adete Akwe, Madeleine Albright's policy on Africa, just summarizing in her overall as a Secretary of State. And I should say that I think one of the reasons that the Middle East is a focal point right now, of course, is because of the crisis that we are in right now with the U.S. about to attack Iraq.
Yes, that's easily understandable. And it's also understandable because Africa is usually not even on the radar screen in terms of policymakers here in Washington. And I think in that sense, Mark might be correct in some way. There's actually a common area between what my two colleagues have said on the Africa policy. A, she's not an architect because she's not initiating a new outreach. B, she is basically carrying out what the administration's policy is, which is more rhetoric than actual policy. So I think I would just end by saying that, you know, there was incredible a sense of promise and hope when she came in to being Secretary of State. And unfortunately, we've not seen that yet. And if we're not very careful, the United States is going to step back from playing a key role in promoting democracy and human rights in Africa, and we're going to basically see the continent lose yet another generation to basically repressive governments.
And today, by the way, President Clinton is expected to announce which countries he will visit in his March trip to Africa. Martha Burke, I give you the final word.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm going to astound Mark and tell him that I do agree with him at least on one fine point, and that is that I am disappointed, as I said previously, about her position, which is the administration's position vis-a-vis the embargo and the so-called collateral damage, which is real people. I also agree with Adete in that there is great promise and hope, was and is, I would add, for her administration as Secretary of State. I think she's already fulfilled some of that promise vis-a-vis women, and we can only hope that she will become a stronger advocate in the future for policies that we all as a people can agree with.
On that note, I want to thank you all very much for joining us and also get some coordinates of each of yours. Martha Burke, your editor of Feminist FactsNet, can you let us know how people can get this weekly news report that comes out of Washington around not only women's issues, but a feminist spin on U.S. policy?
Yes, they can look on the web, if they're on the web, at feminist.com, www.feminist.com, and we are under activism. Or those who are unwired, and I still think that's most of the world, can give us a call at 202-797-0606.
That's 202-797-0606.
Right.
Mark Brzezinski, you've already told us that the Jewish Committee on the Middle East can be found at www.middleeast.org. That's www.middleeast.org. And Adete Akwe, Amnesty International.
And, Amy, if I may add the phone number for
yes.
People who aren't wired on that matter, we are in agreement. There are a lot of people. It's 202-362-5266.
The Amnesty web address is www.amnesty.org. And the telephone number is 202-544-0200.
That's 202-544-0200. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And, of course, we will continue to follow Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton, the U.S. policy on the Middle East, and particularly now on Iraq, as the U.S. decides whether or not to attack Iraq. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, one issue that is close to U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's heart is NATO expansion. And this week she has pressed the Senate not to delay on voting for NATO expansion. President Clinton is kicking off his campaign to win Senate approval for NATO expansion. He's to sign formal protocols at the State Department with the foreign ministers of Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic looking on today. A vote on adding those three countries to the Western Alliance is expected in March. It's up to the Senate to vote on this treaty, and they would need two-thirds approval. We're joined right now by a four-star general from Britain. He is retired. His name is Sir Hugh Beach. And he has come to this country at the behest of groups like Peace Action to say no to NATO expansion. Sir Hugh Beach, why no?
There are a number of problems with it. Basically, it's the wrong answer to a very pressing question. The pressing question is how to make the ex-communist countries of Central and Eastern Europe feel fully part of the Western family, to reinforce their democracies, their civil rights, their free markets, their civil society, generally speaking. And the way that has been chosen, which seems very bizarre, is to invite them into NATO, which is to say a military alliance, whose original raison d'etre was to defend Western Europe against the Russians. Now, that threat has very largely gone away. Nevertheless, it's made quite plain, for example, by Secretary Albright, when she was introducing this subject at the NATO ministerial meeting in Brussels last month, that the number one objective is to prevent aggression against Western Europe in future. And who could such an aggressor be except the Russians? Now, the Russians take this rather badly. They say, rightly or wrongly, they regard NATO as a military alliance directed against them. Historically, that is true. In present-day terms, less so. Nevertheless, it has that overtone. They say that when we agreed to the unification of Germany, and therefore, by implication, the extension of the borders of NATO, that this wasn't on this sort of understanding at all, but that we, the Russians, would be accepted fully among the voices of the West. So we're kicking them in the teeth, is what it comes to, at a particularly delicate moment. They've taken this, on the whole, extraordinarily well. But one wonders very much whether this won't rather strengthen the hand of the anti-democratic forces in Russia, the Zhirinovskis of this world, those who hanker after a revanchist and remilitary attitude to life. And on top of that, quite separately, what we're saying to Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia is, you've got to spend more on your weapons. You're not doing well enough. You've got to come up to NATO standards. This is an odd way of developing their economies. When the IMF go to countries of the third world and advise them as how to do better economically, they're anxious to say always, cut down on your military spending. Effectively now, we're saying to these other three countries, boost it. Now, on these two grounds, it seems to me that there is grave danger of this expansion plan doing very much more harm than good.
Can you explain that point a little more, the issue of NATO expansion really being really being an excuse for expanding an arms market, and I assume that's going to be for U.S. weapons manufacturers in particular?
Certainly, one of the main objectives of bringing in Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia is that they should alter and improve their armed forces up to what you might call NATO or Western standards. That's quite explicit. Surveys have been done of the present condition of their armed forces. It's clear that in a number of respects they don't measure up, and so money has got to be spent. Now, some of this is going to be provided by the NATO membership at large. And the NATO military have come up with a figure of £1.3 billion to be spent over the next 10 years, and of course spread among the existing 16 members. That comes to a trivially small sum of money that each country has to provide. So small, in fact, that it'll be lost in the noise and one mustn't worry about it. But that only accounts for such things as providing a common working communication system between governments, between the military, between airfields and radar stations and air commanders and that sort of thing. And there is very much more, very, very much more that will have to be done. possibly in upgrading airfields, in running pipelines to them, quite certainly in acquiring NATO standard of tanks, guns, artillery, and so forth. Nobody knows how big a bill this is going to be. It's quite certainly many billions of pounds. Of course, it'll be spent over a large period of years. You mentioned American armaments manufacturers, and it's certainly true that they're likely to be involved in a big way, because these countries don't have a sufficiently large armaments, a sufficiently wide-ranging armaments industry of their own, in particular advanced aircraft. Of course, it isn't necessarily the case that the money will be spent in buying from America. Some of the early contracts that have been let have been with the French firm of Matra, for example, and with an Israeli firm, and there's no reason in principle why that shouldn't happen. But in practice, I think everybody realizes that a lot of the money will be spent in America. The question then arises, who ultimately pays? I mean, in principle, it's Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia, but they're not well off. And in order to secure such orders, American armaments firms habitually twist the arm of government to provide money in the form of loans, low interest rates, export guarantee credits, and the like, which means that a large part of the eventual bill is likely to land up in the lap of the American taxpayer. But one can't can't quantify this, save to say that by most calculations, this is a megabuck exercise.
And yet, what involvement will the American people have in deciding whether NATO should be expanded?
The American people speak in the shape of the Congress, and in a matter of this kind, specifically the Senate. The issue comes before the Senate in the week beginning March the 9th in the form of a recommendation from the administration that these three countries be admitted. And they'll vote on it, and being a treaty matter, it'll require a two-thirds majority, which I think means 67 votes. Now, it must be that not all senators have made up their mind, and if the American people wish to speak on this subject, the course of action is plain, that they should get in touch with their own senators by letter, by fax, by phone, by whatever means citizen action normally takes place, saying, have you thought this through? Are you clear that this is in the larger interests, both of the countries of Eastern Europe themselves and of the United States of America? And is it doing the best it can, really, to ensure the long-term stability and friendship of Russia, which perhaps is the most important single factor in the stability of Europe over the years that lie ahead?
What is the alternative?
The alternative, there are many. If the aim, as I've said earlier, is to promote democracy, the rule of law, economic free markets and the like in these countries, then the instruments are already to hand. There is, for example, the Council of Europe, which promotes good democratic practices. There is the European Union, which is explicitly an economic union designed to strengthen and unify the economies of Western Europe. And it is certainly part of the envisaged process that the countries of Central and Eastern Europe should slowly be incorporated. But the work is going very slowly, partly because the farmers in countries like France and Germany don't at all fancy being undercut in a common market by the cheaper producers of Central Europe. So that's a better solution, but admittedly a slow one, and admittedly quite a costly one. And then in the area of collective security, there is already in existence a body called the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. It sprung out of the Helsinki Accords of 1972, the Helsinki Final Act. It then for a while was called the CSC, Council of Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And the point of it is this, that it already includes both America and Canada on the one hand, Russia on the other, the intervening countries, in a security-based organization. Now, up to now, it hasn't done much. It hasn't been able to do much because it's been starved of funds and influence and support, largely by the United States and Britain and France and the other influential powers who've wanted to keep NATO going, haven't wanted the OSCE to succeed. So the alternatives are to build away, perhaps more gradually, through these other proper mechanisms rather than the quite improper use of a military alliance to secure political objectives of this kind.
We're talking to General Sir Hugh Beach. He is a retired four-star British general. He's come to this country for a week to say no, urge people to say no to the expansion of NATO. Right now, the American people are preoccupied, among other issues, with the fact that the U.S. may soon launch an air attack against Iraq. Do you see any connections between the issue of NATO expansion and this aggression towards Iraq?
There is certainly the connection of coincidence in time. I mean, all this is going on at the very same moment. I think that's a total coincidence. You could say there is a connection in that in both instances, the course of action proposed to be taken by the Clinton administration is seeking military solutions to problems which ultimately aren't susceptible of being solved that way. I mean, in the case of Iraq, the difficulty is that we have a ruthless and malevolent dictator determined to maintain a biological and chemical warfare program and a missile program to deliver them against all the odds, and to that end to sacrifice his people to a regime of sanctions which could be lifted almost overnight if only he would declare where these things are and promise not to make them again. Now, the question is, to what extent will a few aircraft carriers in the Gulf, and incidentally there is a British one with the two American ones there at the moment, to what extent will aircraft bombs and cruise missiles launched by these forces, if this is what's proposed, over a few days or a week or a month or so, serve to influence Saddam in a way that all the bombing of the Gulf War wasn't able to do? What are you going to try and hit? Presumably his presidential sites, so-called, in inverted commas, where these, in some of which these things are being made and stored, but of course the whole point is that we don't know where they're being made and stored. The stuff will have been dispersed. He will, of course, shepherd large numbers of civilians into these places to absolutely ensure that as soon as a strike takes place there are huge civilian casualties, which will be very difficult to carry vis-a-vis world opinion. And the other things that we might try and, that you might try and attack are the Republican Guard forces, who are really the military people who keep him in power. Well, their armoured forces will disperse themselves into the desert and become a very difficult target indeed. Or public facilities like water supply and electricity supply, which, of course, is an extremely nasty thing to happen to any country, but whose victims are, to an overwhelming extent, the ordinary civil population who are already struggling desperately to make both ends meet, and which, by most counts of just war principles, would be simply an immoral way of going about it. So I think, once again, the problem with Iraq is that the sort of military actions that are proposed and feasible are extremely ill-suited to the political ends that are sought, which is to say persuading Saddam to take quite different courses of action. And we've simply got to stick for the time being to the diplomatic process. I mean, the Russians are keen and active in promoting the diplomatic process. So are the French. Everybody agrees that somehow Saddam has got to be persuaded to give up this course of action. But I personally think that military strikes of the kind that seem to be now impending are about as bad a solution to the problem as could possibly be devised.
Why is Britain going along with it?
Britain likes to be seen as a loyal ally of the United States. I've often wondered why this is. Perhaps there is a sense in which we are still extremely grateful that the United States saved our bacon in two world wars. Perhaps there is the effect of a common language and a common history, fractured though that undoubtedly is. Perhaps it's purely self-interest in that staying under the wing of daddy, if I can put it in that crude way, is likely to pay off in a number of ways. And we like to separate ourselves from the mainland of continental Europe to keep a distance. You know, we're reluctant to join the monetary union, for example, and to have a strong transatlantic connection is useful to us. But for whatever reason it may be, the British Labour government is just as keen as the previous Conservative governments to keep on good terms with the United States and serve as a willing and loyal ally.
Sir Hugh Beach, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Sir Hugh Beach is a retired 4-star British general who's come to this country as part of a tour to speak about NATO expansion and to voice his opposition to it. He was brought to this country by the national peace group called Peace Action, which is having a protest today in Washington, D.C., as well as other protests around the country against the Iraqi war. If you would like to get the 800 number of Peace Action, it's 1-800-228-1228. That's 1-800-228-1228. And if you'd like to let your senators know how you feel about the issue of NATO expansion, you can call them in Washington at 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. They're expected to vote on NATO expansion in the second or third week of March. Again, the Senate needs a two-thirds majority to pass on this treaty. We've been getting a lot of letters and information about what's going on in Iraq, and we're going to continue to keep you updated. If you want some alternative sources of information, you can check out some foreign newspapers if you are wired, if you can go on the web. Their headlines are a little different from the ones here at home. For example, the British paper The Independent is online. Its website is www.independent.co.uk. That's www.independent.co.uk. And this week's headline, opposition grows on both sides of the Atlantic to attack against Iraq. Quite different from the papers in this country. Another newspaper is the Daily Star of Beirut. Its headline stories are Iraq seeks Arab support as more U.S. troops are sent. Another headline story is about how UN Secretary General Kofi Annan canceled his 10-day visit to Lebanon, which was to begin today in an attempt to find a consensus within the UN that would offer a workable solution short of military action. And you can find the Daily Star on the web at www.dailystar.com.lb. That's www.dailystar.com.lb. And we've gotten letters from people. I'll be reading them through the week. One listener sent us a letter that he wrote to President Clinton talking about his concern about the current standoff with Iraq. We'll be reading those as the days pass here on Democracy Now! Please write to us. Our website is democracy@pacifica.org, or leave your comments on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 588-0999, extension 313, area code 202. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hsu Ku and Laura Flanders. Errol Maitland is our engineer in New York. Joe Gill, our engineer in Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Again, our website, democracyatpacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.